Let's pray. Spirit of peace, quiet our hearts, heal our anxious thoughts, free us from our fretful ways. Breathe on us your holy calm, so that in the stillness of your presence, we may open ourselves to trust and be transformed. Amen. When I was growing up, I had a set of Bible stories and tapes that were narrated by Burl Ives. They were called Bible Time Story Series, and they had stories and Bible songs, and I listened to them every night. And my favorite was the story from today's Genesis passage about Joseph revealing himself to his brothers and forgiving them for selling him into slavery. I give my mom a hard time because she got rid of all of those books and tapes that went with them. And I've been able to find some on YouTube, but not the story of Joseph. The memory of that tape came back to me when I was reading the passages to prepare for preaching today. As many of you know, my dad was a Mennonite pastor until his death in 2008. And thankfully, he followed the lectionary and saved his sermons. And some of the words I'm preaching today are ones that my dad preached in February of 2001. I thought he summed up Joseph's story well, and so did Mark this morning, too, but I have a little more detail. The story of Joseph and his many-colored coat was likely one of the first you learned in Sunday school. But when was the last time you actually read the whole story? Joseph is his father's 11th and favorite son. Jacob had four wives, two sisters, and their two handmaidens. Of the four, his favorite is Rachel. The other three wives all have sons before Rachel has her first. Her first is Joseph, so Joseph becomes Jacob's favorite son, born of his favorite wife. The older 10 brothers become jealous of Joseph. They get tired of all the favoritism their father showers on him. So one day, they make it look like Joseph is killed by a wild animal and sell him as a slave to a passing caravan. Joseph is purchased by a man named Potiphar, who soon discovers that Joseph is a skilled and talented young man and puts him in charge of managing his household. The only problem is that Potiphar's wife becomes attracted to Joseph, makes advances towards him, but he keeps rebuffing her, wanting to remain faithful to his master and to his God. She finally gets tired of being rejected, accuses Joseph of trying to rape her, and Joseph, totally innocent, ends up in prison. While in prison, he interprets the dreams of a couple of officials of the king who also happened to be in prison, but were later released. One day, the king has a disturbing dream, and no one can interpret it. One of the officials remembers Joseph, so the king sends for him, and he is able to interpret the dream. There will be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. Joseph also tells the Pharaoh what he needs to do. During the 7 years of plenty, store the grain so that there will be ample supplies during the time of famine. The Pharaoh is so impressed with Joseph that he puts him in charge of this massive project. When the famine strikes, Egypt is the only place in the whole area that has food to sell. Everybody comes to Egypt to buy grain, and then one day, who should come but Joseph's 10 older brothers? He immediately recognizes them, but they don't have any idea who they're dealing with because Joseph looks, dresses, and talks like a high-ranking Egyptian official. Well, to make a long story a little shorter, Joseph finally reveals his identity to his brothers, and they are terrified. Joseph, with a snap of his fingers, can have them arrested, tortured, or executed. They are shaking in their boots as they stand there face to face with their brother Joseph, who they sold into slavery. But instead of retaliating, Joseph weeps for joy over being reunited with his long-lost family. There are hugs and kisses, and he invites them to move to Egypt, where they will be safe for the remainder of the famine. Joseph responds in such a loving, gracious, and forgiving way because he sees beyond the surface. Yes, it's true, his brothers intended evil for him. Yes, it's true, he spent 15 years of his life as a slave and a prisoner. Yes, it's true, he would have been perfectly justified to take revenge on his brothers for all the suffering they had put him through. But instead, Joseph sees the bigger picture. Joseph turns from being a victim to seeing the hand of God at work in his life and in the events that had happened. Joseph tells his brothers, "It wasn't you who sent me here, it was God. It's all a part of God's divine plan that I could prepare the way to save you and many others during this time of drought. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." This past Wednesday, NPR ran a story on All Things Considered about the power of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s anger. They told this story. When Martin Luther King Jr. was in high school, he won an oratorical contest sponsored by the Negro Elks. He and a beloved teacher were returning home in triumph, riding on a bus, when some white passengers got on. The white bus driver ordered King and his teacher to give up their seats and cursed them. King wanted to stay seated, but his teacher urged him to obey the law. They had to stand in the aisle for 90 miles back to Atlanta, Georgia. "That night will never leave my memory," King told an interviewer decades later. "It was the angriest I have ever been in my life." In the NPR story, they shared this quote from his daughter, Bernice. "If you internalize anger and don't find a channel, it can destroy you. That's why when Daddy reiterated, 'Hate is too great a burden to bear,' he knew it was corrosive and erosive." His friend Clarence Jones said, "From Dr. King's standpoint, anger is part of a process that includes anger, forgiveness, redemption, and love. Because if you only have anger, the anger will paralyze you. You cannot do anything constructive." They also tell the story of King's house being attacked by dynamite while he, his wife, and baby were inside. He rushed outside and realized that his supporters were standing there, some with weapons ready to retaliate against the people who had done this. But Dr. King talked about loving your enemies instead of seeking violent justice. Forgiveness is difficult, and love is difficult. In the scriptures from Luke, we get some very unambiguous instructions from Jesus. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you, do to others as you would have them do to you. Do not judge. Be merciful. I think we've all heard these words before, and we also do our best to follow them, but it isn't easy. I know I judge, and I haven't always done good to those who hate me. How can we go about forgiving like Joseph and loving like Jesus? Where do we even begin? One way that Jesus showed love is by being present with the people around him. In his book, Reconcile, John Paul Lederach says, "When we approach the challenge of reconciliation, we tend to ask for the steps, the model, the process, the toolkit, and all the techniques. When we approach the life of Jesus, however, questions of method or technique may not be the best starting point. His ministry did not rise from recipes or in the words of the environment around him or from the law. Jesus' ministry had roots in grace, expressed primarily through the quality of presence. The way he chose to be present in relationships and in company of others, even with those who wished him harm." Later in the book, Lederach says, "Love and compassion hold the center. These require a fullness of commitment. They emanate from the gut. They burrow and rise in the soul. They fill and focus the mind. We find an extraordinary description of presence. To bring the whole of yourself into the present moment in gratitude to the source, the creator of life. Jesus lived in a way that was continuously aware of the sacred around him, and he had the extraordinary capacity to see the person and greet the humanity, the divine in the other. The key to his presence was in his capacity to notice the humanity of others, especially those most invisible and neglected in his day and time." In 2016, I wrote the following blog post for The Mennonite. It was on a series of about parenting. 11 weeks before our first son was born, my dad died suddenly. 2 days before he died, my birthday, he was at my house laughing at the fact that my pregnant belly was the one that created distance between our hugs. Then he was gone and everything was different. The end of my pregnancy and the first few weeks after his birth were a mixture of my greatest joy and my deepest grief. My dad was going to stay with us for a week after my husband had to go back to work, and I haven't felt such a profound absence before or since. My dad was the person who was always available to me. I would call with a simple question for him to answer or just to have someone to talk to. Growing up, he packed my lunch every day and made me coffee in high school. We had inside jokes and hundreds of shared memories because our connection was important. I want to be the parent he was. When I look back on what was most important to me as a child, it was his presence and attention. It wasn't necessarily what he said, but that he was there. He read me bedtime stories, sang me lullabies, played games with me. He saw me, he got me, and he knew me. He taught me a lot of things, but the most important thing is to pay attention. He always saw hawks flying beside the road. The first time I saw a bald eagle was because he spotted it while we were driving. He also loved to walk through the recently plowed fields in Ohio hunting for arrowheads. He paid attention to the weather, to gardening, and to God's calling in his life, among other things. After he moved to Colorado, he recognized the important role that water rights play for farmers here, and he started to learn everything he could about that. He taught me the importance of paying attention to each other, remembering people's names, a joke they thought was funny, or something important to them. When Ian was younger, we would spend time at dinner talking about our favorite part of the day. With intention, we would listen while the other person was sharing. It became something Ian would ask randomly, "Mommy, what's your part today?" When we asked him, he usually said, probably eating dinner to you. Now at the dinner table, we ask each other what we're thankful for. Sometimes it's hard to get anything serious or deep out of a 7- and 4-year-old, but we feel that making it a point to do these things now will show their importance in the future. One of the saddest things about losing my dad is that he isn't here to be a grandpa to my kids, that they don't get that attention directly from him the way I did. My hope is that Ian and Shane will feel my dad's love and presence through my actions as a parent. I struggle daily to live up to that, but my dad also taught me a lot about grace, and for that I am grateful. This can all seem simplistic. However, as a beginning, we can learn to forgive like Joseph, and through that forgiveness, to thrive with grace and compassion, to see that hurt and betrayal can sometimes be catalysts for love and healing, and we can learn to see the humanity in all people like Jesus, to truly pay attention to that of God in all people. For my dad's memorial service, my sister and I shared the following. I found this poem a long time ago in a magazine in the waiting room of a doctor's office. I don't know why, but Dad and I like to be together. No matter whether we talk or not, just like the birds, Dad and I feel words. When I was 15, my best friend died in a car accident. In the weeks and months that followed, I was shattered, sad, and lonely. One evening, my dad asked me if I wanted to come with him to a spot he enjoyed going to watch the birds. I decided to go along. His presence was healing for me. We didn't talk, we just walked along the creek in the woods. For me, that evening became a representation of who my dad was in my life, a soft place to fall, a place to be reassured and safe, comforted by presence. Brooke and I both had dark nights of the soul, where we searched for God in a torn world. It was hard for either of us to grapple with a vengeful God who did not love everyone equally. Interestingly, we both have very similar experiences discussing our concerns with our dad. When my sister was young, she asked my dad about Tibetan monks and how they could go to hell because they don't love Jesus. She had watched a movie, and she understood that they are good, peaceful people. My dad told her this. I heard a story once of a missionary who went to Tibet and told a monk the gospel. When he was finished, the monk said to him, "This is what I have had in my heart all along. I just did not know what to call it." I also want to read a portion of a sermon my dad wrote. We try to define ourselves by means of things with even less importance than our relationships. We define ourselves by our careers or define ourselves by our wealth and property. You can try for yourself. Start with the sentence, "I am," and see what you add to complete it. What are you? How do you define yourself? Jesus tells us that in the bigger picture, there is no way we can define ourselves that is more important than our primary existence. We are children of God. That is who we are. I am a child of God. You are children of God. At the very end of the day, or at the end of our lives here on earth, what defines us is our relationship to God. And that means that even now, the God who is God of the living wants us to live as though our first identity is as God's child. For us, claiming this identity plays out in how we prioritize our lives. The choices we make, the paths we choose as children of God. And we can live in the knowledge that in our living, in our dying, our days and our lives belong to God. What is eternity like? I'm not sure. None of us can be. As much as I like having all the answers, I'm learning to be okay with not being sure about the details, because I'm sure about this. I am a child of God, and so are you. And I'm a child of the resurrection. Even now, God offers me new life, a living relationship with a living God. Today, remember who you are and whose you are. Your identity is in God's hands. Let this love from God, this label you bear as God's child, be the label that shapes your life and the way you live. And know that today, yesterday, tomorrow, and in whatever age the future brings, in this world or the next, nothing in life or in death can sever the relationship between you and God. That indeed is the good news of this gospel message. That is one thing my dad taught us about grace. My dad had many interests: bird watching, cooking, gourmet meals, gardening, flowers, Scrabble, water rights in Colorado, farming, canning, Sudoku, being a pastor, exploring new places with my mom. I could go on and on. Sometimes he told the strangest stories because so many things interested him. I have to admit, it wasn't always interesting to me. But because he knew a lot about a lot, I called my dad often, at the very least once a week. I would say, "Dad, I have a question," and would proceed to ask him anything and everything. Should I do budget billing on my Excel bill? What's the difference between sweet potatoes and yams? If you're making spaghetti for 12 people, how much would you make? How do I get my mums to bloom more? I would do just about anything to ask him a few more questions. Isn't it amazing the things you miss about a person? I learned what it means to really be alive in the world, to be aware and interested, to do the things you love with the people you love. Pay attention to their words, their lives, their interests. Spend time just being, just watching, just living. I'll admit that I don't have many answers. I know we should love and forgive and grow our circle to our neighbors, to our communities, to our church, to immigrants, to politicians, to extend grace when we can, where we can, to hold our judgment, to live with compassion, and just do the best we can. To end, I'd like to share a story that my dad wrote. My mom and dad celebrated his 47th birthday by visiting Hawk Mountain Sanctuary in northeastern Pennsylvania, one of his favorite spots. On this particular morning, they soon discovered that the wind was coming from the south, making it less an ideal day for southerly migration. However, after some time, they saw hawks appearing on the horizon. The following are my dad's words. They were identified by the spotters, while still at a considerable distance, as red tails. As they approached, however, they did not look like red tails to me. The wingspan was too short. The wings were bent in a W shape rather than the extended out in a straight line as one would normally see them. One of the visitors to the mountain asked a staff member about this. The staff member informed us that the winds aloft were so strong from the wrong direction that the hawks had to sort of tuck their wings and use their tails as rudders in order to make any progress on their journey. Ornithologists have long researched the migration of birds and have attempted in particular to determine how birds know when and where to fly to get to their destination. Although there are differing theories and conclusions, all agree that it is so deeply ingrained that it is an internal part of what it means to be a hawk. A hawk does not have the capacity to wake up one September morning and decide whether or not it will migrate this year. Something deep within its being compels it to migrate, and it does. And if the wind is from the wrong direction, it does not go with the flow and migrate in the wrong direction. It pulls its wings and works its tail and heads south where its inner sense calls it to go. It seems to me that as Christians, we could learn something from these hawks. Theologians may differ on exactly how the call comes to us, but like the urge to migrate, our sense of call to follow Christ should be deeply embedded reality that we cannot escape. We should not be able to wake up in the morning and decide how we live today. Something deep within us should compel us to live, and we should live that way, even during the times when all the winds that blow around us seem to be blowing in the wrong direction. We do not have the option of giving up. It is during these times that we must pull in our wings and work out another method, rather than going along with the flow. As followers of Christ, we have been called to set the course and show others the way, rather than allowing the prevailing winds to take us where they will. May God bless us as we faithfully follow.